This is the Senate Committee on Human Services. Meeting date is April 1st, 2005, at 1 p.m. We have the Jim Webb Community Center on Sweet Home Oregon, chaired by Senator Ben Northam.
I'm going to call the Senate Human Services Committee together, and I want to welcome you all. I really appreciate the opportunity to be here today in this beautiful center that was built by the citizens. We were here a couple of years ago, and we took a tour and we told the story of how this place was put together, and it's something to be really proud of. Before we get into the business of the committee, I want to acknowledge Craig Martin, city manager, Craig Fenneman, the mayor, Friedman, the mayor, Ken Toons, the mayor of Lebanon, and Craig and I, when I was the mayor of Springfield, we had a rap at Oxford Stadium in 1992, I believe it was, and his daughter got him into the rap mode, and it was quite exciting, and we may do that for you during the intermission today. Craig, are you ready? I'm going to have our professional staff person, give you some information.
Thank you for that. If you haven't picked up an agenda, we will be doing a number of bills today. So if you want to talk to a specific Senate bill that we'll be doing public hearings on, you'll need to sign up over here and we'll get the sign-up sheets just before we do the bills. There's also a section on the agenda for like an open public hearing on long-term care and access to prescription drugs. And so we ask people to also sign up. There's two sign-up sheets for like open public testimony. But we won't be able to call you up and know that you want to testify unless you actually sign your name up, so you can do it any time. Excellent.
Thank you. I'd just like to familiarize you with the makeup of this committee. I don't know if I should use the word liberal conservative. I guess I would say a moderate progressive to a moderate conservative. I'll ask Senator Cruz to introduce himself in just a moment. As soon as I'm through talking about him, he can introduce himself. The first session that I was here in 1999, I served on the House Health Committee, Health and Human Resources at the time, and Senator Cruz was then a representative and he was the chair of that committee, and so I served on the House, I believe in 01, and I think in 03 I was in the Senate, but I did work with him. I was the vice chair of that committee, I think in 01, and now he is in the Senate and he is the vice chair of the Health Committee. And he brings a lot of experience and expertise to the committee. From my perspective, we work very well together, but I will let Jeff introduce himself and tell you a little bit about his background.
Well, thank you, Senator. It's nice to be here. I've been in the legislature since 97. I did chair the House Health and Human Service Committee for 3 sessions. And it's wonderful to be here. I'm one of the original board members of the Boys and Girls Club of Umpqua Valley. We received our charter 2.5 years ago. And so I was there from the very beginning. And when I pull up to this place and see a senior center connected to a Boys and Girls Club, I think that's just got to be about the most wonderful thing there is. To be able to connect seniors and kids is absolutely awesome. So I congratulate the community on the foresight of not only combining the facilities, but in the close to school. It's amazing. It's really well done. So took the tour of the Boys and Girls Club. Nice facility. We're in a capital campaign in Roseville right now to make something I hope will be as nice. So I really love these theater rooms. I like to get out of Salem where real people live. And so looking forward to the day. We've got a couple of good bills. Hopefully Senator Starr will make it here so that we can actually take action on a couple of the bills that are on the agenda that are really nice bills. So I'm looking forward to that also.
Thank you. Normally, we do have 5 members of the committee. 1 member is traveling this weekend to Hampton. Well, she's at a conference, actually. That's very important. And another member could not be here. Senator Charles Starr will be here soon, and that will give us a quorum so we can pass some bills that we are going to hear. Okay, we will start with the informational meeting and long-term care issues, challenges, and trends. And Chad Martin, would you please come forward? Yeah, okay. And bring your friends with you, Chad.
I didn't know that anybody considered Jim Carlson a friend.
So we are opening the informational part of our meeting. And if you would introduce yourself, Chad, when you before you give testimony.
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm happy to introduce Carlson from the Care Association. What we've got today is 2 administrators who are working here and have worked for many years in Linn County, providing services to seniors and people with disabilities locally. Chad is the administrator at Lebanon Rehab, which is a local skilled nursing facility. Chad has worked in this area in the Albany, Sweet Home, and Lebanon area for the past 8 years and has excellent first-hand knowledge of some of the issues and challenges here. And then following Chad will be Linda Lern, who's the administrator of the Oaks Assisted Living in Lebanon. And Linda is a veteran assisted living administrator who's been at the Oaks for the past 13 years. So with that, Chad.
Thank you. I'm Chad Martin, administrator at Lebanon Rehab. Formerly administrator at Twin Oaks Rehab in Sweet Home for the last 3 years. I moved to Lebanon just last September. And have presented you with some bullet points in sheet of paper. At the top being the core values of our company. I don't want to go through those individually, but they helped me put together the rest of the page, so they helped me every day. First, I talked about Lebanon Rehab itself. It is licensed for 117 beds, currently operational 84 beds. I'll tie that in order to the state of things in long-term care. We currently employ 85 people in the Albany. Average census in 2004, 72 per day. Of those 84 beds, 72 referral, sometimes more, sometimes less. Payer mix in 2004. The number 74% were there utilizing Medicaid services, welfare, 11% private, 14% Medicare, and just 1% HMO. The length of stay, which also plays into the challenges that I'll go into later on, 17% stayed less than 2 weeks. Of all of those folks discharged in 2004, 17% stayed less than 2 weeks, 57% stayed 2 weeks to 3 months, 26% stayed or had been there more than 6 months. Add those top two together and that 74% were there just less than 20 minutes. The clientele we serve, 75% admitted from Lynn County. Hospitals in Lynn County, straight from home, assisted living, foster homes, that kind of thing. 24% from Benton County and 1% Evan. Maybe the odd one from the HSU, same hospital, sacred heart, that kind of thing. And the challenge of an issue is, number one being the census. The West Home of the past is no more. Our residents are sicker. And there are alternatives now. I consider it a good thing that the West Home of the past is no more. The alternatives being in-home care, assisted living. These are good things for the people we serve. And the acuity is increasing though. In a skilled nursing facility, that means our folks are sicker. Our resources generally stay flat, if we can keep them there, if we can keep them going down. But we're expected to give a higher level of service to this dwindling population.
We have a question. Thank you, Chair. Mr. Martin, or panelist, the discharge is 2 weeks to 3 months. I know some people leave because they pass away or are discharged back home. You keep data on which folks either go back to a hospital or go back home or leave.
Yeah, I might ask Jim Carlson for the record. The handout that I gave, there's a table there, table 3, which is statewide data for 2003 for nursing facilities, which was the last year we had complete data. And that shows you the discharge destination for all nursing facility patients in the state. And what you'll see is that almost half of all people admitted to nursing facilities are discharged back home. And as Chad indicated, you know, generally in less than 90 days. And so I think as Chad was indicating in terms of lengths of stay, what you really see skilled nursing facilities doing today, and following up on his theme of the rest home of the past is no more, is folks are really focused on rehabilitation and getting folks back and up and on their feet or back stabilized so they can go back to more independent living situations, either back at home or in the community. So almost half, as you can see on that chart, are discharged back home. 17% that do die there are end-of-life care situations. A very large percentage are discharged back to community-based care. And Chad can talk a little bit about some of that in this service area.
Sure. Specifically to Lebanon Rehab in 2004, 21% of our discharges go to death. That is quite contrary to the rest home in the past. That's 45 of 212 discharges. 167 locked up, which is what we like to see. Another challenge I'd like to address is the service we provide. Going back to the core values at the top, the best service is all that is acceptable. A professional healthcare service is what is expected. It's what I expect from my staff. It's what the regulators expect from me. Yet, and this is the best I've seen it, the wages we pay for CMOs, which are our workhorses, $7.50 to $12.50 an hour. We expect a professional mentality. On a day-to-day basis, people that really receive online staffing. I call it the desperation mentality. It's has been epidemic to hire someone just to meet the minimum required staffing levels, not to mention the quality of their character. I've seen it happen. I've even been in that position. or in the community, having been in Albany, Lebanon, and New Sweet Home, staff move from facility to facility more often. The less desirable staff, as administration turns over, the old ones come back, and not having been remembered, some of them may have been let go. Stability in administration is something that we use to eradicate that mentality. If they've been there before and they didn't do a good job, you don't want them again. I will work before myself, expect my nurse management staff to work before themselves before I hire someone who's just going to do a bad job. And risk a complaint, risk a survey for not meeting the required numbers of staffing level. The workforce is aging. That goes without saying. Finding new people who are as energized as the past is getting harder. The work is physical and emotionally exhausting. The compensation is not there. Adequate and stable funding. 74% of our clientele receive services. We provide services to these people for $5.82 an hour. It's expected by me and by my regulators to be the highest quality service. That's $139.96 a day, about the same price as dinner, a movie, and popcorn for a family of four. Indeed, too much is too much. I try to study the legislative process and the budgeting and where things go in our society and what I may consider appropriate, not appropriate, efficient, and not efficient. I expect the money I receive from government programs to serve the person it's supposed to serve. I don't like overhead and redundancy and inefficiencies, and that's how I run my building. You don't need too much, but too little in the system that I create. It's a very tight system. Too little affects them, these seniors, directly and immediately. It's how I see the state of long-term care. And then, Ken?
Okay. With that, I'd like to ask, actually, Linda Lane, who works in assisted living, community-based care, to give a little bit of an overview of kind of the issues and challenges she sees.
Hi, thank you for letting me come here. It's a lot easier to speak at this than going to the legislature and sitting in front of the committees, which I've done before, and that's a little more nerve-wracking. I've been at the Oaks for 13 years, and I'm probably one of the...
Did you identify yourself?
Oh, I'm Linda Lane. I'm the administrator. I've probably been one of the longest-term assistant building administrators in the state of Oregon at this point. I have 62 apartments, and those 40 of them are people that are funded by Medicaid. I have about 55 employees. I'm one of the larger employers in Lebanon. And they provide a lot of money into the community and salaries and food and our electricity, water, and all of those. My average person is 84 years old. They've been there 3 years. The oldest person I have is 98 years old, and the youngest is 56. I've had people there since 92, and I have been living in Wednesday. So the average, they do stay a long time in assisted living. One of my concerns is that with the budget cuts that are projected, I'll be losing $20,000 a month to help take care of these people. And I just want to show that on the table that several things have been proposed that we would have to cut services, maybe decertified beds, children's retirement housing. There are several of those, but we certainly cannot keep up the level of service we have now or the projected budget cuts. So my average age is 84. It's somebody that's come from home. She lives in the apartment. She's confused. She needs help with medication. She can't remember to take them. She needs help with bathing or moving off and refuses to take a bath. She wanders. She has a walker. She's around thinking of frequently when neighbors call and she's down the road a ways. And we have to go and talk to her and turn her around and bring her back. And at this point, she's a little bit of a burnout, but at some point she probably won't, and then I would call and chat and say, guess what, we need somebody in the room that the doors are locked. Assisted living, we provide care for a lot of people that in days gone by would have been in nursing homes or best home complex. Now we're taking care of them in assisted living. They're pretty complex care needs, and they manage fairly heavy care. Do you have any questions?
You're in Lebanon?
Yes, I am.
Okay. And you handle the greater Sweet Home Lebanon area?
Most of my residents do come from Lebanon. They either have family that live in Lebanon or they move them in to Lebanon from other areas.
Okay. If a person has to leave the Lebanon area, where do they go then? Do Albany maybe, or is there another?
Sometimes they go to Albany, but sometimes they go to Sweet Home, Brownsville, or some foster home.
I guess the concerns that I think we all share is to keep people in their own community, and they need either restaurant or assisted living to keep them close to the family, and I think it's really important to make sure that we maintain our local facilities for the elderly, and that is a big priority. How is your vacancy rate?
I run about 96% occupancy.
So,
and I at times have a waiting list, but that's only as good as a day with the people on it. Because if they have to have a place to live, then they do go somewhere else if it's an emergent need. Often we get people, like Chad does right from the hospital, they'll call and say if they have a room, we can they admit somebody, and if we can, they can. If not, they'll go somewhere else.
Okay. I guess I'm more interested in the trends. What are the projections for the next couple of years or into the future in terms of occupancy and maintenance of your facility and costs that you might have to incur to stay open and so on? Those are, I guess I'm talking about capital cost and building and so on.
We just recently restarted the whole building, and that was like $200,000 and put new carpet in and painted on the hallways and new tabletops. And you have to keep it up because most of our people are in wheelchairs and lockers, and they go down the hallway down into the walls, and you have to keep constantly doing capital improvements. It's a huge amount that you have to set aside for that.
Which adds to the expense, of course.
Oh, of course.
Now, what about your projections for the future?
We are projecting that we're not going to add on at this point.
Okay. What about need for the future?
Well, at times we could use more and other times we can't. There was a period of time where the other assisted living rentals had quite a few vacancies.
Oh.
So we feel that we're right about right now. The moratorium has really helped out because it's cut back on all the other building.
Okay. By the
way, we have a million coming in at this point, yes.
Oh, a new facility.
A new assisted living.
Well, the projection, of course, is that there will be greater numbers of seniors at baby boomers. And so the long-term care is probably one of the most important issues we're going to be addressing in the future, is how to maintain the health of seniors as we have a greater number of seniors. So I don't think we've seen anything yet.
Well, they're
coming.
They're demanding more and more too. They want, extra lines for the internet and the vegetarian diet and, they want burgers. And that's, this is today, and
yeah.
I mean, 10 years from now,
yes,
this is going to be
10 years from now, those baby boomers are
going to
want their private rooms and private televisions and private
baby
boomers.
It's really quite interesting to see the changes.
Mr. Chair, I just can say Florida has overtaken California as the state to set national trends, according to some folks. And of course, Florida has a lot of seniors that have been there. I think Florida's population increases by about 800 a day, but they project that by the year 2010, only 49% of the people in Florida will be of working age. So there is a nexus coming.
Okay, we're going to have to move on. Jim, do you have something to wrap up?
The only thing I'd say, Mr. Chair, Jim Carlson, for the record, is some of the information from statewide data and trends is in the handout I provided you in terms on the growth that you've seen and what's projected. And I think I just wanted to say thank you to both Linda and Chad and the other folks who are involved in caregiving professionals in the field across the continuum, because it's very difficult and demanding work and very important work. And I agree with your sentiments wholeheartedly. It's important to keep these systems strong in smaller communities throughout the state. So thank you for the opportunity to be here today.
Thank you very much.
Jim, do you think the moratorium extension we're passing now will be the last thing we're going to need?
Mr. Chair, Senator Cruz, our internal discussions and looking at projections on population-wise on the 85 and up population, which is the population that really drives need for long-term care services, about 2010, that's where the demographics really start to take off. So our discussions have been that we think probably an additional four-year extension is warranted, but at that time, we're probably going to want to, you know, allow for some growth to keep up with the demands on the demographics. Due to the grandfathering in of about 90 projects at the time the moratorium was passed, it has allowed for continued growth on a more measured basis. For example, here in Lebanon, or just close by here in Lebanon, there will be a new facility coming on that was one of the grandfathered projects. And so I think for about four more years, we need to make sure we're maintaining that stability in the marketplace, and after that, we're going to have tremendous growth.
Well, in the sense that some of those that are grandfathered that are just sitting there may disappear with the new bill, so.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Senator Charles Starr an opportunity to introduce himself and say a little bit about his history in the legislature and where he's from and how many years he's been married.
Quite a to-do yesterday. My wife and I celebrated 49 years yesterday, and we had a little party at the Capitol. I've been 6 years in the House, and this is my last session in my second term as state senator, and enjoying good health, and I look forward to any last time soon. In fact, I feel good enough, I think I could run again. I've served on
open source senator.
I'm serving on human resources, I think, for the fourth consecutive session, ever since I've been in the Senate. I've served on human resources, and I've seen the scarcity of resources. I've seen the demands exceeding our ability to fund, and concerned me greatly. Issues that require attention, and we're going to do the best we can. We've established a revenue amount for the first time since I've been in the legislature. We did that early, agreed on by both chambers of the legislature, so balancing the budget now is a matter of dividing up the variable revenues, and hopefully to get that done, about Salem that delayed me, and I'm sorry to be late, but I'm glad to be here now.
But thank you. I just want to say about the Senator Starr, he was very gracious when I was in the House and he was in the Senate, and he would always hear the bills that moved over to his committee. We have bonded, I think, in a couple of ways. We're both farmers. I have 8 blueberry plants and maybe 3 rows of corn in an 8x8 patch. Now, Senator Starr, you tell me about your blueberry patch.
I have 3 acres of blueberries in my house. So we discussed corn planting and blueberry culture and a lot of issues.
Now, the secret of blueberries, in case any of you are interested, is they need a special kind of sawdust. Right, Senator Starr?
They require fir sawdust.
Fir sawdust around the tops of the plants, because that will create a particular kind of, what does it create?
Creates a particular kind of mold.
Mold, that's what we're looking for. So you have the secret of blueberries now.
I'm humbled sitting next to you two farmers, because my farm's only 600 acres.
What is it about your farm? He's a professional farmer, because he has a, you do commercial business from your farm.
Yeah,
that's right.
Just an overview of what we've been asked to talk about today is the modernization of Oregon Project Independence, which is a the Medicaid diversion program that encourages options for seniors to remain in their own home and age in place rather than to enter a nursing facility prematurely, but also it's a great Medicaid diversion program. So we're going to touch on that today. And we are certainly not going to read all this material that is in front of you, but we will reference it, so that is why we brought it. And so thank you very much. I'm going to let you know what we do have in here, though. We do have a piece that talks about what the area agencies on aging do, and that's for the benefit of people in the audience, maybe who might be interested in that. We have a talking page on the modernization plan for Oregon Project Independence. We've been working on that for several years. It's 30 years old, by the way. We have a talking points paper on some of the misconceptions around Oregon Project Independence, because there's so many programs that serve seniors, and sometimes there's some confusion around it. We're going to just touch briefly on the relative foster care issue. We'll also just touch for a moment on equity. We're very familiar with it. So we have included for you a list of the governor's recommended budget proposal cuts for seniors and people with disabilities, and we're up to, I think, about $90 million now, and I think we actually even owe money for OPI right now. We're calling it OPI IOU.
This is mostly up in State 70.
Yes. We'll touch upon, quite honestly, the cuts in the governor's budget actually point toward the need for OPI modernization.
Right.
We're not sitting there and going to spend any significant time on any of them. But, and then we've also included some copies of some legislation that pertain to OPI modernization this session. But I promise our presentation won't be as long as the papers. So I'll turn this over to Ted Stevens right now.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Ted Stevens. I'm the Director of Senior and Disabled Services with Lane Council of Governments. We're an agency that serves basically seniors and people with disabilities in Lane County. I certainly am glad that you're here in the Sweet Home today. It's a little closer to get to a meeting like this rather than going all the way to the Capitol. I'd like to touch just briefly on Oregon Project Independence. As I'm sure you are very well aware, OPI was first enacted by the state legislature in 1975. It was really a key program starting to move Oregon in the direction of addressing the long-term care needs of older people. The program itself provides for support to keep people in their own homes, those people who are at risk of losing their independence because of their inability to care for themselves. It's been an extremely valuable and very popular program over the years. Unfortunately, it has been a victim of the downsizing that has occurred because of the problems with the state budget and the generation of revenue to support ongoing services. As recently as 3 years ago, the biennial appropriation for OPI was about $17 million, state general funds. We're currently operating with $8.5 million for the biennial appropriation, and the governor is recommending just a little over $3 million for the upcoming biennium. And as you can see, that's a pretty steep decline. As a result of that, we're serving far fewer people today than we served in the recent past. It's a program that really has a great potential, but quite frankly, right now is not meeting that potential because of the inadequacy of the funding. And we're hoping that this legislature will be able to not only consider modernizing the act, but is bringing it forward from its initial form 30 years ago, adding some features that I can either touch on right now or later in the public hearing on Senate Bill 875. I don't know.
Let's do it later.
Do it later? Okay. good. Well, I just wanted to let you know that this is an extremely valuable program. As Jacqueline indicated, there are some kind of misconceptions about the program. People, for example, think that we're serving a very well-heeled population. I think the data will show, in fact, that most people who are benefiting from OPI are low income, and those who have resources, because there is a sliding scale, are basically being asked to pay either a portion or all of the cost, depending on where they fall on that sliding scale. It's a program that's targeted to people. I mean, we have to have certain levels of impairment even to be able to get into the program. We follow the same approach in terms of the process for assessing people's service needs and so forth. So it's an extremely valuable program. One of the other misconceptions is that because it's 100% state funded, that is state general funds, it's not a good program. That is, it doesn't leverage Medicaid dollars. And I know the department and the other agencies have looked into that question, and there's really very little opportunity to leverage Medicaid match, but at the same time, the cost per case in this program is extremely low compared to the cost per case in the Medicaid program. So even though it's not leveraging additional dollars, it's still a very good deal for the state of Oregon and for our taxpayers.
Well, with that, I will stop.
Fred, I think you know that we're all strong, strong supporters of the program, so
good.
Thank you very much, Senator Cruz.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Scott Bond. I'm the Director of Senior and Disability Services for Cascades West Council of Governments, and we cover Lynn Button and Lincoln counties. Welcome to Eastman County, welcome to Sweet Home. Appreciate your coming here to hold this hearing. Just one small piece to add to what Ted said about OPI modernization, and that is that the opportunity that this affords us to look at the potential of serving the younger disabled in addition to the seniors that have historically been served by this program. Everything that Ted mentions about the program, which currently serves the seniors, is also true from the standpoint of the younger disabled and being able to provide cost-effective support in the community, in people's homes, is very important to their families and to their clients. The relative foster home part of our presentation, again, very short, in that it's a very critical part of our system. In the governor's proposed budget, it's been targeted for elimination. Approximately 1,880 people being served statewide for about $22 million in general funds. And in this level of care, relatives caring for a family member, this is the least expensive level of care that we have in community-based care. And $839 on average per case per month, compared to the average of $1,366 per case, $500+ less per month in this level of care. It was interesting for us in Albany. We held a forum with people from across Lynn and Benton counties who are the providers of relative adult foster care in our communities. And many of those people showed up to talk to us about what does this program mean to them. And without going into the stories themselves, the piece that I walk away with when I hear these stories is that we have achieved a programmatic level of care that allows for families to help families. And to do it at a very inexpensive price tag. And we have given the seniors and people with disabilities a chance to experience the dignity of being cared for within a home setting by family members. And it
excuse me. Scott, there was a gentleman sitting in the front row when I came in, a 93-year-old gentleman who came to speak but had to get home to take care of his wife, and I believe, did you talk with him?
I did not have a chance to do that.
Okay. Bill, would you like to come up then? I didn't have an opportunity to address the group, and there were several people who did talk to him, and I don't want to get into the personal details necessarily, but this is, I think, why we're here. We're here to hear the problems of people who live in this area. Now, that gentleman probably would not go to Salem. He couldn't stay here because he had to get home. What generally was his problem?
Senator Morissette, members of the committee, I'm very well aware of the executive director of Cascades West Council of Governments. And Herb's issue was, at his age, he has very limited mobility himself, but his highest priority is his wife of 45 years, or probably more than that. Sorry, I can't remember exactly. But his wife is in need of almost constant care, which is what we find when we look at people who are getting relative foster care. He has a need right now to have an operation to allow him to continue to walk. And he's had one already on one leg, and now he needs the other on his other leg. He's made the decision that he would rather not be able to walk and leave his wife, because she needs him continually. And he realizes, because of his previous operation, it took only 13 days away. But he, because of that dedication, cannot afford to be gone that long. This is the kind of person that we see in relative foster care, the kind of dedication we're getting for the $800 and some. And it's important to know that, well, he's 93. Many of our relative foster care providers are, in fact, the children of the people that they're caring for. And their big issue is, how do I live if I'm going to drop what I'm doing in my career and stay home and give 24 hours care for $800? How do I live? Well, I've got to have that $800. And the important point is that if they can't afford to stay home, because we put that rate or eliminate as the governor has proposed, those people are going to have to go out of the home, lose their intensive care, and be in a facility that's going to cost the state more. It's not cost effective, as well as it's not human to cut that piece of the system.
Well, thank you very much, because I did talk with him, and he was distressed because he did have to leave, and I know that there are a couple of people who did have a chance. Now, his immediate need is the care for his wife. Now, does he, I don't know if you know that, but Project Independence, is he receiving some in-home care, I wonder, from anyone, an agency? That's my business. Does he have a caseworker? That's, somebody said he talked to his caseworker. I don't want to delve into this publicly, but I guess I'm raising the issue that here's an individual who is elderly, who is in need of an operation, is foregoing that because he doesn't want to leave his wife alone, who is, I don't know what age she is, but infirm, and he needs help. And I am hoping that there is help in this community through someone, either neighbors or some agency or some funding of some kind, or at least, you know, Project Independence may or may not be involved in this. I don't know.
He does have a caseworker, and according to our senior U.S. program director here, they're trying to address his needs, of course, beyond what he can provide. And I think that's an important point, too, that ties all the system together. We have a senior center like this, and a senior leadership program, we are able to provide extra support for that relative care. But it's still the core to have that relative assistance. It's very, very much needed, and it's going to be very disruptive to our system of care if we eliminate those people.
I know that there are individuals here who know, obviously, this person, and I'm hoping that his problem will be addressed, but that's what we're facing statewide. We're facing cuts in the very programs that keep families and young people alive, and it's a very difficult time when we have to prioritize what to cut. And there will be no new money. We will not have additional funds to do these things. So, and we're making cuts. Each agency is asked to select 10% of their budget in a prioritized fashion, and that makes it very, very difficult. So we rely on the community. And so I'm hoping that within the community his needs will be met. So anyway, thank you.
Yeah. Senator Morissette and members of the committee, I guess I just wanted to tag right on to that issue and just bring up one other point as well, and that has to do with the whole question of the funding for staff for the local agencies, what we call equity. In this case, not knowing anything about the case involved, but certainly if there is a case manager that's working with the individual, ideally that case manager should have enough time to be able to leverage some of the other resources, whether they're formal resources or informal resources in the community, to address the needs. And because of the problem with lack of funding from the state to the local government agencies that are doing this work, effectively in Western Oregon, where the AAAs are the main providers of services.
AAAs, these were
The area agencies on aging.
Okay, we're the acronym free. The acronym for that is AFZ.
The area agencies on aging and disabilities, which are the major providers of these services and are the employers of the case managers, are basically being underfunded by the state, at least in compared to what the state will provide for their own staff and state-run offices. And there was a bill that was enacted 2 years ago by the legislature, House Bill 2288, which essentially set a promise to begin to close the funding gap between what the state provides for itself and what is provided to the local governments that are the sponsors of these area agencies. And unfortunately, the money to begin to close that gap isn't in the governor's budget, and recognizing that there are a finite amount of resources, I would hope that you in your capacity as legislators, when you work through the budget process, will begin to think about how to fund that equity gap, particularly when you're looking at the fact that state employees may be getting, salary adjustments and so forth. But basically, the AAAs deserve some attention as well.
Now, could you tell me what year Lynn County and other counties took that function over from the state?
Well, we took that function over from the state in stages, starting in 1983. Right now, because of the problems having to do with the methodology for funding.
I'm sorry. It seems to me that when I was the mayor of Springfield and I was on the council of government board, and this issue came before us at one point in the 90s, and my comment at the time was, what's going to happen when they don't give us the money to fully fund the program? And I said, we should give it back to them. I said that at the time. And the state has done this with local corrections. They've done it with this particular program, and the state has placed it off onto the local governments, the responsibilities for the programs, and yet the state does not fund the program, and that's true with education also. And so it's across the board. They're not giving the funding. And some counties have turned their corrections program back to the state, and just for that very reason. But it is frustrating. There are some things that I know we're not going to give it back. I don't think we are, because one of the vicious circles is the less money you get, the harder you work, and people think you're doing a good job, so why give you more money? And that's the way it goes. So, anyway,
I think you've answered all of my
questions.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Well, I'll give a wish and thank you too, because we did sponsor some of the 77 meter session, which is going to be funding for us. A final piece we wanted to offer to Mr. Chair and members of the committee is that the governor did impose a cap on the number of clients we can enter into the long-term care system. The number has shifted a little bit, but maybe 21,500 might be just about right. And currently we're serving a little under 30,000, I think. 5,000 of those are in nursing homes or so. So what that means is, if that cap remains in place, that over the coming biennium, we'll be limited as to whether or not we could actually serve people like the gentleman that we saw earlier. If he was a new case, we might really not be able to serve him if he's number 21,501, no matter what his level of impairment, unless he wanted to go into a nursing facility or something along those lines. So this cap is one of the best examples of penny-wise and pound foolish that we've seen in a long time, and a couple of that's eliminated. But again, all of that sort of brings us back to modernizing more than project independence, and it is becoming a safety net for seniors, and it's got a lot of flexibility, and it can help meet some of the needs when there are cuts in place, but certainly not all of them. And we'll talk a little bit more about that when the bill comes up this afternoon.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We're going to reverse that a little bit, because the thing I don't want to do is run out of time by dealing with the bills, which we could always pick up later. I want to be sure that we hear people who've signed up to testify, people locally who've signed up to testify. It's not too late. So we will call. We will close the information hearing. We're going to open a public hearing, and Alicia Jubilee, I believe, and Terry Hayden, would you come up, please? Yes, why don't you, Alicia, why don't you come up?
Yes, good. In the packet is a letter from Ms. Cuba that I had a copy of and brought, and it should be a last item in the packet at the bottom.
Why don't you come up also?
Go ahead and
Pull the microphone up real close and relax. We're all just folks, so let's relax. We're having a conversation.
My name is Alicia Juber, and I live in McMinnville, Oregon. Do you need my actual address? I just returned from Washington State, where I was caring for my in-laws, who are in their mid-80s. And everything I'm hearing here today, they would love to have up in their state, I'm sure. And they feel a lot of things that are happening for seniors all over the country. So they really backed my coming here today and being able to address you. So thank you very much for this opportunity. I'm sorry to have to address some of the more negative sides of some of what I've heard here today, addressing the long-term care issues, knowing about the scarcity of funds, but that's what I have to do today. In 1998, at the Sheridan Care Center, a long-term facility. My father, John Eber, was given extreme doses of morphine, which resulted in his unnatural death. The nurse who administered the morphine was on an encumbered license from previous charges of dangerous acts towards vulnerable patients in his care, starting in 1993, 5 years earlier. The nurse, Mr. Coons, worked at Sheridan from November 97 to February 98, and during that time, Sheridan had 5 hospice patients, and it was the only time there were hospice patients at the center. He took control of them all, and all but one died rapidly, either on his shift or right after. The one who survived did so only because he was, quote, no longer put on the schedule. She was put on hospice by Mr. Coons, the nurse, according to records. I first learned of this when approached by an LPA from this facility 8 months after my father had passed over. She said she could no longer carry the guilt. I'm here today before you because the system in place in our state to protect the lives of vulnerable patients within the nursing home failed miserably in this case. Something must be done not only to see justice in the case I present, but also to protect future citizens within our state from this heinous type of crime. This is not an isolated case, and hospice almost lost funding while it endured a potential criminal investigation as to the policies that were not being followed. I believe in hospice profoundly. This was an isolated hospice in a small town. Within that a nurse with such a stained employment history and mental health condition could have a nursing license and been again accused of heinous behavior, the last letter of license lapse is appalling. Not the board of nursing allowed his license lapse. The ease with which this nurse was able to order such a potentially dangerous narcotic from a pharmacy, I added this, without the appropriate patient assessments is also appalling. The lack of reporting suspicious incidences which are required by law, and if so, reported to the supervisors only to have those employees threatened or ignored, is heinous. The fact that Health Legacy Hospice failed to act when a case of morphine abuse was noted. The local office of senior services being supported understaffed that it takes 6 months to complete a report on such egregious allegations and that a report required an apology at the state level for the poor quality in the reporting. The incredible lack of action on the part of the district attorney, known as initial investigator, showed proof of wrongdoing to assure a grand jury, but chose to lag on a case for 8 more months while statutes ran out. The same lack of sensitivity from, I'm sorry, this is a harsh thing to say, but it is what I experienced. From the DOJ, the Department of Justice, Mackinac, as they too figured away 5 months before letting me know the only charge possible is criminal negligent homicide, but the statute had run out. I know this is harsh, but it's what I feel. These things and more can only add up to a tragic failure in this state by its agencies and laws to protect vulnerable citizens of the most basic rights, the right to a natural death with dignity and protections from the predators who have denied that right. I ask you to do all... for the poor quality in the reporting. The incredible lack of action on the part of the district attorney, known as initial investigator, showed proof of wrongdoing to assure a grand jury, but chose to lag on a case for 8 more months while statutes ran out. The same lack of sensitivity from, I'm sorry, this is a harsh thing to say, but it is what I experienced. From the DOJ, the Department of Justice, Mackinac, as they too figured away 5 months before letting me know the only choice possible is criminal negligent homicide, but the statute had run out. I know this is harsh, but it's what I feel. These things and more can only add up to a tragic failure in this state by its agencies and laws to protect vulnerable citizens of the most basic rights, right to a natural death with dignity and protections from the predators who have denied that right. I ask you to do all you can to stop this atrocity by looking into this case first, knowing it is not an isolated one that touches a million areas. This can't start the debate in our assistance, about our assistant suicide law and penalty that was written in the media, of course, when it first was brought to light. But if there are flaws in either that may have contributed to these deaths, then wouldn't it be wise to readdress these policies? I'm doing that because of what I have heard today, the walks the fact that many of these agencies have to hire to these long-term care. They have to hire as cheaply as they can many times. The fact that, as I said, this is not isolated, but how do they nurse? I mean, there's so many things addressed here. I would pray you would have time to look into it. I really thank you for your time today, and I came back to this case after all these years. It's so been very difficult for me because I believe nothing is going to be done in this state because of what I ran into when trying to just get justice done. It took over a year to get somebody to look at it in the first place. It was because the White House is now doing a conference on aging, our Senator Wyden and Senator Smith are working very hard to try to see where the Justice Act passed, which is an extremely important piece of legislation. We're trying to get it, we present it to the 109th Congress, I mean, along with all the other sponsors. And it would be, because I mean, people just don't seem to care, and that's when this case was first presented. I had people approach me and say, "My God, that happened in the nursing home anymore." And I said, "Did you tell anybody? Come forward. Does it matter? Who cares? Nobody will do anything anyway." And that's what I found out. And that's what hurt me the most over the past few years of attempting to pursue this. And that is why not wanting to have federal interference, quote unquote, within state policy and legislation is understandable, and at the same time, sometimes seems needed. I would just plead and beg of you to, if you have time, to look at some of the factors in this case only in that they relate to what happened within the Board of Nursing. It's a white man, it's a lot of his license left. He can still get a license in another state. Why hospice did not respond when they are told the night my father is being put to sleep, he's being given excess doses of morphine, and makes their they chose to do nothing by law they are supposed to. These things happen, it is not isolated. So I thank you for letting me present this to you today. And thanks.
Thank you. Jackie, can you get some information specifically about it?
Ms. Chair, we've had a conversation, and it was very difficult to get responses from the appropriate people that you referenced. We're still kind of like into it, but I think she's right. Something that I've seen since statutes have run out that they have no need to respond, and that's been disturbing. At this point, we have been, in my office, relatively unsuccessful in getting where we would like to go with this.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, perhaps.
Thank you very much.
Yes. Perhaps we can talk about this with you at a later time.
Okay. Yeah, we will pursue this. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your time. Thank you.
I guess this is one of the reasons that we'd like to get out and hear what people, what the concerns are locally, and I think this is a very important issue. There have been incidents at different times when those in charge of elderly patients have been responsible for their death, and sometimes it's not found out until much later when it's too late, and it's hard to go back and change something that's already happened, but that makes it all the more important to make sure it doesn't happen again. And I think the safeguards absolutely have to be in place. And again, it's hard to do to recruit people to work in jobs that are difficult. They have to have a motivation to do that, and 99.9% of the time it's because they care. And I don't know what would prompt a person to do harm. That's the first thing first rule, to do no harm, and we're there to help, and to have someone to do something of that magnitude casts a shadow on the whole industry and so on. So this is extremely serious, and we will do what we can. Thank you very much.
My name is Mabella Gates, and I live here in Sweet Home. And what I would really, I guess, like to address is relative foster care. And what you just said kind of backs up what I would like to say, and that is you can't give the type of care in any situation, but you can from a relative, and a loving relative. We work 24/7, 365 days a year. We give up our lives for our parents, for our aunts, for our brothers. We do that happily and gladly, because we certainly aren't in it for the money. But if, the patents, money dries up so that we're not given anything, we're going to have to, I for one, will have to go to work just to pay the bills. I mean, it's not a lot of money, but it does cover our utility bills. I have to $32,000 a year job to take care of my mother. I then added my aunt with Alzheimer's to it because her daughter had to work and couldn't stay home with her. I kept her till she retired. Now I've added my mother-in-law. And my husband has MS. So, and he's in, getting into the advanced stages of it. So it's not only too long till I've added him. You know, and I would not want one of these people, as long as I'm capable of taking care of them, in any kind of a foster care or a nursing facility, which is many times more than what you pay the relative foster care, they are still able to have more independence than they could even in a foster care. Yet they need care because they cannot do the housework. They do not remember to eat. They do not remember to take their medication. Or they forget when they do take it. You know, they may overdose. They may not take it at all. So they need this care. And somebody just coming in once in a while still isn't going to do it. And they're still going to pay more to have people come in to do housekeeping, to bring in meals and cook for them. Meals on meals, but we don't get that every day of the week. You know, so what are these people going to do if you take that away? Many, many of them, I'm afraid, are going to end up with no care at all. So, I guess that's all I have to say. And thank you very much for giving me this opportunity to speak and listen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Questions, comments?
Question?
You have you're a caregiver for three individuals now?
Two. Yes, and even on this also, you were asking about caseworkers.
my caseworker, and I'm sure this goes with many, are so busy and they have so many people out there, I get to see her once a year.
Yeah, I was going to ask about the caseworker.
But once a year. Now, yes, if I have a lot of problems or something that comes up, I can call her. But she doesn't have the time.
Thank you.
Sonny Swanson?
I worked as a CNA for several years. One of the places I worked was the home in Lebanon that was not there anymore, thankfully. I had been in Lebanon. Only two of those were even able to stand on their feet. Several of them had Alzheimer's. I didn't have time to take care of these people properly. One gentleman that I took care of was incontinent. This nursing home didn't even have diapers for these people. I would go in every morning and this gentleman was wet from one end to the other. And they strapped him in his head because he would try to get up and go to the bathroom, but he couldn't stand on his own, so he's dropping in bed. I don't know, I worked on this, so I don't know what happened during the night, but I know when I would come in, he was saturated from one end to the other. And I would have to help him get out of the bed, in the chair, and take him through. By the time I would get through getting everybody up, it was time to go back, take him out, in to eat, it was time to take him back, and maybe they didn't get the underwear changed all day long because I did not have the time to do it. So we kind of joined forces then. I retired early. I was living in Idaho 3 years ago so that I could come down and give my dog breaks with Annie and Mom. Mom can get around pretty much. At that time, she could pretty much run. If she's down once again, this girl who gets telecommunication, that kind of thing. She'd fall. And this was constant, 24 hours supervision. You don't get back in the nursing home. They come in, they check on you, they go back up. I know that for a fact because I worked there. And she doesn't get paid enough to. She said it pays me terribly, that's about it. So I took early retirement, like I said, and as soon as my husband was older, he took early retirement so we could move back down here, so we could be here to help with them. And my cousin Joyce has the aunt that has Alzheimer's now, she's getting the phone. I'm going up to stay with her for a week in May so that she can have a break from taking care of. Because as long as it's a 25 thing, you can't leave them alone. I really wonder what we would do if they took the family from in home care. I do this all on my own, help her, but she doesn't do that just for staying with her and caring for her. But we do it because we love them.
To this, and I have
multiple sclerosis. I was diagnosed almost 27 years ago. My MS has been progressive during those 27 years, and now as you can see, I have a very useful movement below my neck. I've been receiving in-home care for about the last 11.5 years, and previous to that, I worked in the hospital 2 or 3 times in about the 3 years before I was started receiving care. Since I've been receiving care in 11.5 years, I've been in the hospital once. And I think that's a pretty good record, and it basically is a testimony to the people that have been working with me. I've had a large number of caregivers in the past, but the reason I look like I do, and that my health other than my MS is as good as it is because of the care that I have received. And the caregivers that work with me, they don't have holidays because Christmas, other holidays, I need to care for the care that doesn't matter. And they manage to work together as a team to be able to give me the continuity of care that I need. This means that if one of them is ill, and they should not be lonely because if I get ill, that is very detrimental to my health. That means one of the other caregivers needs to fill in. And sometimes this is at the last minute, and they will need to come and fill in night shift, which is extremely difficult. The amount of care that I need, because of the degree of my disability, is really quite extreme. I look like I do now, but I need to be basically transferred into bed. I need to be moved around in bed so that if something needs to be done, I won't go into details of how spare it is. But basically, I am totally dependent. And so the caregivers that work with me have to fill all of my activities of daily living. And this is a very large amount of work. I started doing a task list of some of the things that will be carried on every night of the year. And it came to a total of around 50 or 60 very work intensive items. And the scale of the letters involved is it's very high, and when I do interviews with my caregivers, it's rather difficult to try to find the quality of person that is necessary. I also wanted to talk a little bit about I depend upon a network of care. In other words, there are the caregivers that I need. I need to have a nurse. I need the housing authority benefits that I received. I have a kind of housing card that it's a very delicate system. And if any one of these pieces, for example, the vision and dental, benefits to HP Plus, those benefits are very important to a lot of people who receive long-term care because if their dental health suffers, they have a very difficult time maintaining other aspects of their health. If they lose coverage for their pharmaceutical benefits, that would be extremely, that would hurt them tremendously. The cuts that are occurring now, which right before the baby boomers hit, the time when they need long-term care, and I just would like all of you, would like everybody to try to think about What is the system going to look like 20 years from now? And how is it going to meet the needs of what our world will look like 20 years from now? Thank you for this opportunity to speak to you. If you have any questions, I'd be very willing to answer.
So what is your living unit? Describe your living unit.
I live in a 100-foot square foot apartment.
Okay. So is that an apartment that you rent? Is that?
I rent.
Yeah, okay. So it's you live in a private, personal apartment?
I live in my own home.
Yeah, okay. And it is... allows you, New York City, to look where you have to go, and you're able to get out.
That is correct. I live at the ramp that was built by a friend, and he's an engineer, and so it's basically meant to go to the wheelchair.
Okay. Good.
And so I guess that is another aspect of it. I also depend upon a network of informal supports. From friends, from neighbors, I have next door neighbors. If I have any sudden need, I can always get a hold of them. And if they will come and make a phone call, they'll come and make, they'll do what they can to help me.
And you have no control of your limbs, is that what you were saying?
That is correct. I can move my hands out really good. That's why I'm not using them.
You're looking good, and you're cheerful, and in very difficult circumstances, and I think your attitude is probably what is most important about keeping you going, your attitude, and your positive outlook, and in very, very difficult circumstances, and I'm sure that's why people are willing to work with you and want to work with you because of your attitude. You're an inspiration. Okay, and I appreciate your being here and your words because we have to hear over and over and over, we have to hear these things. Thank you.
Thank you.
Gary Hayden. Okay, and Mayor Toombs, if you could come up with one.
Very good, go ahead.
Chair, Mary Sutton. My name is Terry Hayden. I live at 2601 Northeast Jack London, Space 29 for Dallas, Oregon. I am a client employed provider and represent client employed providers or the home care workers from NCIU Local 503, the Home Care Workers Union. I'm going to be reading from the script if that's okay.
Go ahead.
Okay.
Sure.
In our first union contract, we won the right to have basic health coverage and workers' compensation. I would like to share with you today why that is so important to me and to my clients. The healthcare coverage we now have has literally saved lives and very well could have saved mine. Having healthcare coverage keeps home care workers safe and healthy and helps us to provide quality care for our clients. In December May of 2003, I noticed that I had lost 15 pounds between Thanksgiving and Christmas. That in itself is not unusual, but people usually gain weight during that period of time. In January 2004, I was continually losing the weight. I lost my strength and I lost stamina. My skin color was taking on a weird dullness. By March, I had gone from 185 pounds to 150 pounds and I was still continuing to lose the weight. In April 2004, my health insurance and workman's comp became available because of the victories in our union contract. I went to the doctor as soon as I could and discovered through many tests that I had a thyroid problem. It was not working correctly and it was getting worse. Had it not been for affordable health insurance for home care workers, I would have continued to lose weight and I would have ended up in the hospital, and this would have been devastating to me and to the three clients that I care for daily. As a home care worker, I make sure that people that I care for in their homes, that they can retain their independence and choice. I do my job better when I'm healthy and supported. And having health insurance and workman's comp is a huge deal to me and to my clients who rely on me. I know that with our workers' compensation, no health insurance company will offer us health insurance needed to keep the home care workers safe and healthy. As home care workers, we are one of the only workforces in the state that has to negotiate the right to have workers' compensation. I think the state should value us enough to automatically give us this basic right of workman's compensation. I know there are several people in the legislature that are sponsoring bills to make it mandatory that home care workers receive workman's comp, and I applaud their work. However it works out, I hope that this committee will support our right to be safe on the job through workman's comp, as well as our right to negotiate to have health insurance. I also hope that when you look at the budget figures, you realize that this program is not about money and numbers, it is about people, like clients and myself. Home care is the fifth largest force in the county, and we are larger than the huge employers like Georgia Pacific and Lane Benton Community College. We are here to care for Oregon seniors and people with disabilities, and to support our community. We hope through this budget process that you can support us too. Thank you for taking the time.
Thank you. Do you have any data on numbers of injured workers in your field? I'd like to get that because I know that it's very difficult to bend over and move someone in a bending position. It's very hard on your back and so on, and I can see the stress levels on your body, but just the positions that you have to be in trying to balance someone and having them fall to one side and you having to compensate your weight. And so I think it's a vulnerable position to be in. So I know that there are some bills to improve you on the workers' comp. Now the next thing is how do you take care of the injured workers under workers' comp is a different question, which is also very troubling. And a gentleman from Lebanon, Scott Wood, has been working now for three sessions, and I've been working also to expand the injured worker program. He's working on the educational part of it. If an injured worker has to be trained to get a sedentary job, it's something that takes up to 2 years. He was cut off before he finished his program, and we heard just the other day in committee his bill to correct that system under SAFE. Unfortunately, there was no mechanism, the same mechanism to correct it under Liberty Northwest, but it's a reoccurring issue. How do you take care of a worker once injured who is under workers' comp? I mean, that's the second battle we're going to have to fight. So if you get the workers' comp, then... So these are difficult times and difficult situations, and I know you have the bill, and I will support the bill. So I do appreciate your comments. Okay, thank you. Mayor Toombs, thank you for being here. I'm sorry I didn't call you up sooner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Marsad and the rest of the panel. Senator Starr,
I've been married 48 years. I was only 12 when I got married. However, I was last
out. You want to introduce yourself for the record?
Okay, I'm Kim Tomes, mayor of Lebanon, Utah. I live in Lebanon. I've been there for a long time, 40-some years. I was asked to talk about prescription drugs. I'm very humbled to be here because of the people that have testified before me. They really got some serious problems. But 2.5 years ago, I was diagnosed with prostate cancer that had, I was inoperable. I couldn't operate on me, so it had metastasized into my lungs, and so they put me on medication. The medication has worked wonders, so it's in control now.
Introduce yourself for the record.
Okay, I'm Kim Tomes, mayor of Lebanon, Utah. I live in Lebanon. I've been there for a long time, 40-some years. I was asked to talk about prescription drugs. I'm very humbled to be here because of the people that have testified before me. They really got some serious problems. 2.5 years ago, I was diagnosed with prostate cancer that had... I was inoperable. I couldn't operate on me, so it had metastasized into my lungs, and so they put me on medication. The medication has worked wonders. It's in control now. I feel good. I have no symptoms, so I'm very fortunate, and I'm so much luckier than the people that have testified before me. But one of the drugs that I take is called Casodex, and that is it's a drug that affects the pituitary gland and the adrenaline glands. And that drug in the United States is from $390 to $410 a month. And the doctor gave me a month supply to start with, and they say, well, you're on your own. I get that drug now out of Canada. Same package, same wrapping, comes from the same manufacturer in the States for $214 a month. So I know there are people in the audience that have trouble with the drugs, and the drugs are very expensive, but I just thank you for listening to my experience here, and I know that you have other problems that you're trying to come up with money for, disabled people, the elderly, and at some point in time, the government needs to start helping those people that also have prescription drug problems.
I mean, the other card. I need your card.
Okay.
What I have in mind is the industry, and you may have been through this already, but they do have a program that will help people with particular drugs, and it depends on the pharmaceutical company. They each have a different program. Have you been involved in that program?
I don't qualify for those.
Well,
You might. These programs, they're real for 300% federal poverty, when you wear that.
It's been a change. In fact, there's legislation, and Senator Bates is sponsoring some legislation to kind of see if we can simplify the product, because each company, obviously, because there's proprietary issues there, they've each got their own program, and we're trying to figure out some way that we can at least get a centralized way to get into those systems. But just this year, they expanded those programs considerably up to 300% federal poverty.
Yeah, can I get your card?
Oh, yeah, you'll do that. And we're
Senator Cruz and I are meeting with the pharmaceutical industry and others to expand a program that came into effect last year. Actually, it started March 1st. We passed the bill in the last session, and it's a bulk purchasing for people. It's a fairly limited group, but it's individuals 55 and older who are 185% of poverty and who have been without insurance for 6 months. We're working to expand the program to include more individuals, and I know 300% of poverty, which is quite a bit higher, is in use now. In fact, the pharmaceutical industry is using that, will be using that figure, 300%. But I will take a look at, and I'll talk to some of the people from the pharmaceutical industry. They had a series of meetings last year in response to the medically needy program, which we cut, and so there were a number of people who used very expensive drugs for cancer, and who were basically cut from that program. The pharmaceutical industry did step up and help. They provided free and reduced prices for drugs, and I think I'd really like to look into that for you and be in touch with you or anybody else who finds that they are in this kind of a situation where they have a serious illness and or a potential illness or something in remission and want to keep it that way, and their drug bills are run out of sight. So there are various programs to help. That's a really important issue, and AARP has been working, and I see a representative from AARP back there, I think. Somewhere there he is. In fact, Rick, you might talk to this gentleman also and see what if you can help. So this, I'm really glad you brought that up, because that's another area that people who are of medium income or even high, relatively high, have a certain kind of drug that they can't afford, and so there are ways that can be mitigated. So
certainly, so a high income, I make $200 a month as mere revenue, so
I think you qualify.
Okay.
Well, see, I didn't make anything as far as Springfield.
Well, you didn't have the right council.
Okay. And Craig back there, he's been mayor. Now, he's been on the council, let's see, for 17 years, and he's been mayor four different times, so you know your friend Craig back there.
Yes, I do.
You can join our rap next time you have
it. Thanks so much for
the work. The committee's over.
Yeah, you probably, if I'm going to be in it, you got to work on it. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you. Okay. Which bill shall we hear? Let's do the
we're not going to hear them all. We have about 15 minutes or so, and we do have people to testify for that. So I will close that segment of the public hearing, and we will open a new segment of the public hearing in just a moment. Long-term care case management for a fee for those who are eligible for services.
It does require appropriate funds to include crisis services, rest, and special needs. It does repeal a section of law that requires separate counting people age 60 and older with Alzheimer's, and does appropriate general funds. It does have a subsequent referral to ways and means. Thank you, Chair.
Okay, I only had half a fear and half a trepidation thing. I don't see you shepherding the office.
Should we walk in and meet it?
Oh, goodness, let's wait. Yeah, I want Ruth to have an opportunity to speak because she also wants, has something to say, but go ahead. Now, we have about 15 minutes and we're going to have 15 to 20 minutes, so.
Thank you, Senator. For the record, my name is Dolores Hubert. I am chair of the Governor's Commission on Senior Services, and as I told Vic earlier, I submitted testimony in support of the bill. The OPI program is the most cost-effective way to serve the needs of the growing population, and I do mean growing. Senator 8 expands services that may be provided through Oregon Project Independence to include crisis service, respite, and special needs. And I'm going to let my written testimony stand and let someone else testify. Is that okay? That's it. For the sake of not taking up any more of your time, I gave you some bedtime reading. Thank you, sir.
Well, I am truly disappointed.
Another time we'll engage.
Ruth, you're up, Ruth.
What's
that? Ruth Shepard, you're here to talk about Project Independence briefly.
Just a brief overview of Ruth's statement.
Mr. Chair, Oregon Project Independence is unique. It is run as a prevention program effectively. It has
Ruth, would you introduce yourself for the record, please?
My name is Ruth Shepard. And in 1972, the legislature was receptive to the idea of Project Independence, and it was worked out in a couple of early committees that, in fact, because there was only nursing home care available for the person who needs public support, it was thought that home care was a very, very important thing to be added to the choices. And when we got the letter from the federal government about the dollar being just for nursing homes, we made it possible. In the public sector, this was private. These were people that were not otherwise eligible for low-income programs, but that they didn't have enough home care. They were going to be unnecessarily using the care of nursing facilities. And it turned out to be over time that was right. Never a problem. And I'm proud of the effort that the OFRAD makes to give these services as they do. We're back where we were, however, in which through a series of judgments on the part of the legislature over time, it looks like we're almost back where we were when we have nursing care, but not home care. And when we anticipate that the Medicaid dollar from the federal government is going to be capped, and for home care as well as others, we can see without any question that it's either going to be a flat usage and expenditure of the general fund. It may not keep up with the demand at all, in fact, given the increase in populations. So what else is there available for home care project in the past? And so it's extremely important to protect that general fund and to protect people who need services in their own home. The perspective on Project Independence and all of the long-term care, I think, is a good place to start and end discussions, because it has to be said for our children and grandchildren that majority of us will have aches and pains and a few hitches in the get-alongs and not feel too great, but we will go to our graves without dependency on others for care. And we need to keep that in mind, because those people for whom the state has responsibility or is willing to take responsibility are the ones we're talking about. I'm just short of going any further on the financing, Mr. Chairman. I do fully support the testimony that's been heard and the continuance of maintaining enough home care positions. We have to grow that program in order to put us back in balance, because we're not in balance now. And there are people who are on the public dollar unnecessarily and at higher costs. That is an untenable policy.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your comments.
Senator Scott.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. How does hospice care relate to Project Independence, or does it?
Well, I think I would just soon have Jack and answer that. Because I'm not sure. The question was, Mr. Chair, how does hospice care relate to Project Independence? There's certainly a clear need for hospice care, but I don't know if it includes that, and I suggested maybe Jack could comment on that.
We are going to hear the testimony, and we're going to move. I think we're going to move the bill. And then
I'd just like to say that we hear a lot of comments about care in facilities, and just as I'm listening to that, I just want you to understand that we work very well with the facilities and the nursing homes, and the folks associated with those programs in Oregon, and they do provide care when in-home care is no longer the best resource, and we're thankful that they're part of our long-term care system. So we need care in Oregon, and that 80% of our care, of our Medicaid care, in fact, is provided in-home and 20% in facilities. But in a state like California, it's the exact opposite. 20% of their care, Medicaid care, is in-home, and 80% is in nursing facilities. So Oregon nursing facilities are part of our long-term care system, and they're doing their very best to survive, and we support them. At any rate, what we wanted to talk to you about today, and I know in the interest of time, we're going to skip a lot, but what we've been working on for the last number of years is a modernization of Oregon Project Independence. We've been trying to prepare for the incoming numbers of seniors that are coming to Oregon, moving here or already here, and the number of people with physical disabilities, the increasing number of people with physical disabilities. And we're trying to help people with their own personal responsibility and reliance upon themselves and the resources around them as far as their care goes. We want them to just be ready and self-sufficient. And we've been meeting for a couple of years with the state and with other aging and disability organizations to talk about how best to prepare for that incoming wave of people. And we decided that modifying the Oregon Project Independence might be a good way to go, because there's so much flexibility in the program, and it's done at the local level. It uses local resources and takes advantage of them. But what we wanted to do was just kind of help get the state ready for the demographic trends coming in. And so to that end, we've been meeting and with all these different groups that I mentioned, we come up with what we're calling the OPI Modernization Act of 2005, which Senator Morstead is sponsored for us. So what I wanted to do was just ask, I'm going to ask Ted here to talk about the four or so components that we find in Oregon Project Independence Modernization Act, and then we'll stand for questions. But before we get very far, we'd like to answer your question about hospice and Oregon Project Independence as well. So, Ted.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ted Stevens. I'm the Director of Senior Disabled Services with Lane Council of Governments. If I can first answer the question that Senator Starr posed, there is a role for OPI in the hospice situation. We're actually doing that in Lane County using dollars, and it's really just to supplement what services are already being. Most people who are in hospice get some support through Medicare, but it doesn't always meet all of their needs. And sometimes there are families and friends that can fill some of the gaps in terms of meeting the care needs for somebody who's at the very end of their life. But oftentimes there aren't those kinds of supports. And after the Medicare resource runs out, then basically there's a gap, and that's where Project Independence can come into play. And as I say, that's one of the things that we're doing in Lane County with our OPI dollars, is actually supplementing, filling those gaps for people who are on hospice. So it does work very well together. It's not duplicative, and it's very complementary. So then back to the specifics of what the Modernization Act, Senate Bill 870, accomplishes. As the committee administrator mentioned when he introduced the bill, it does add people with disabilities to the service population for Oregon Project Independence. That's something that at least the people with disabilities that I work with in Lane County have been trying to have us accomplish for the last decade, and we're very pleased to see this added to the bill at this time. It also really clarifies some of the provisions of the bill, modernizes them. If you think back to 30 years ago, basically the long-term care system were nursing homes, very little else. And so the intent of OPI is to help keep people out of nursing homes if they were able to stay in their own home with some supportive help. Now this is being modernized to recognize that there are really a lot of other options for long-term care besides simply nursing homes. So the eligibility is really clarified to help provide help for eligible clients who are in their own homes when they're no longer able to take care of their daily care needs without assistance. So that's basically bringing this into the 21st century in terms of understanding. As was mentioned earlier, it does expand the number of services that can be provided, including crisis services, respite, special needs, but also, and I think very important, given the demographic that we're looking at, the bill is requiring and calling for education and information to help people take more responsibility for planning for their own care. And the idea is to create a website that would be available particularly for people who are either thinking about their care needs going forward, or if they're beginning to plan for meeting the needs, say, of a loved one, like their parent or something, to have a readily accessible public source of information to be able to help think about and plan for meeting those needs. And so that's one of the key things, is to add this to the bill. And then finally, the other important piece is to enable the provider agencies, the area agencies on aging and disabilities, to provide case management and do it on a fee-generating basis for those people who would have the resources to pay for the service but who may not, in fact, know where to turn to get the help. And so I think those are the key features of the Modernization Act, and we would certainly hope that this committee will support the bill going forward.
Mr. Chair, if I could, we think it's interesting that the area agencies on aging and disabilities. One of the other ideas that came up as we worked with groups about OPI modernization was making OPI a platform for promoting the purchase of long-term care insurance. And again, that speaks to the idea of personal responsibility and self-reliance, self-sufficiency. The more people that are aware of good long-term care insurance policies, the better the odds are that they won't be knocking on the state's door in a number of years when they find themselves in an episode where they need some help. And so very few people, I think only 4% of the state's employees take advantage of the long-term care insurance that's offered to them and their families. So that could certainly be of use to all of us here in the state. If we gave long-term care insurance away, we'd probably still come out ahead. So that's another concept involved in that.
That's a very good concept. One of the things that we don't always look at is the cost shift from one program to another program, and here we're shifting cost from a little bit of help to keep a person independent to total dependency by being put into a facility that costs a lot more money, and that's a good example. But we usually are preoccupied with solving the immediate problem, and we don't always think of the bigger problem. And so thank you very much, and we will hear this bill again next Thursday.
Yeah. Thank you.
I'm going to close the public hearing on 870, and we're going to open a public hearing on 430. Okay, open public hearing on 430, May.
Oops, dash.
Yes, would you go ahead and
so we did get it from back a couple times this does require self-home workers to get the community education. There are some dash two and dash three amendments. The dash two amendments disturb some language about broadening it to no person who provides care. It does change the hours from 14 to 12 total and allows Department of Human Services to use this training from 7 to 4. And I understand Department of Human Services and adult foster home industry are in concurrence with these amendments.
Thank you. Would you introduce yourself, please?
My name is May Dash, and I represent the Alzheimer's Network of Oregon. On February 22nd, the Oregon-based Alzheimer's Network of Oregon sent you a letter regarding Senate Bill 430. We had been unable to attend the hearing that you had on February 15th. And the network is a nonprofit organization that supports the educational, social, emotional, and spiritual needs of individuals with Alzheimer's, their caregivers, and their families. We do not support Senate Bill 430 as written, or do you think that the amendments that you are considering will resolve our issues? These are the few reasons that we have a problem with this bill. First, we strongly believe that annual continuing education should be required of all caregivers working in adult foster care homes, not just providers, which by definition include resident managers. Most caregivers believe that more, not less, training is desirable. The majority of them receive low pay and have no workers' compensation, even though the other three types of long-term care facilities, those caregivers do have workers' compensation coverage. These ones in adult foster care do very difficult work that can result in misery, but the injury that they are not covering. We emphasize in our February letter that caregivers need ongoing training to help them work with and respond to the specific needs of residents in an appropriate manner, particularly those who have Alzheimer's disease. Continuing education for all caregivers should help to prevent unnecessary harm to both residents and to staff. Second, because an estimated 60-70% of the residents in Oregon's long-term care facilities suffer from some type of dementia, commonly Alzheimer's disease, we urge that all caregivers receive annual continuing education in dementia care. Since business training, which most caregivers do not need, is specified in the bill, we suggest that an equal number of hours be devoted to educating caregivers about the complexities of Alzheimer's. And third, specifying numbers and types of continuing education hours seems more appropriately addressed by administrative rule than by ordinary by statute. Over time, as conditions mandate that such details be revised, even to a small degree, changing the law would be both time-consuming and cumbersome. Furthermore, whenever the Department of Human Services considers changes to administrative rule, the agency works with a sizable group of stakeholders representing both providers and advocates. That is what is happening now with regard to the residential care facility rules. Thank you for considering our concerns and suggestions.
But you can't leave yet because we are truly considering them and we have to talk about this. Grover, could you come up, please?
I'm sorry, I forgot to do my testimony.
Well, no, that's fine. And I'm wondering if we should not, are you suggesting that we expand the bill? Is that what you're saying?
Well, first, we believe all caregivers in adult care should have continuing. And second, we do believe there should be an Alzheimer's component to it. And third, we really think it's very cumbersome to put it into statute. We think it should be an administrative rule because as things change, there's a need to change the hours and that sort of thing. And we think it makes it much harder to change if it's in statute.
Okay. I appreciate that, and the good thing about administrative rule is that they can adjust to change. The bad thing about administrative rule is that they can do away with everything that you want to have happen. And so I guess my feeling is that you have a statutory parameter that within which there is administrative rule. And I agree totally that, you know, administrative rule obviously needs to be there to make the necessary changes when they need to be changed. But I'm just wondering if we... First of all, I'm wondering if we need to expand this bill, and secondly, to make it a decide boards to allow the administrative rule to, you know, set the up-to-date requirements. But I appreciate you being here because I want to. That's why we have the public hearing on that bill. So I appreciate that. Greg, do you want to respond to that?
I will, Commissioner Chairman.
Thank you. Identify yourself if you would.
For the record, my name is Grover Simmons. I represent adult foster homes who are members of the Independent Adult Foster Home Association. To put this into context, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, the current law requires, as all of you know, 10 units of continuing education. And the bill that we...
considering them and we have to talk about this. Grover, could you come up, please?
I'm sorry, I forgot to do my testimony.
Well, no, that's fine. And I'm wondering if we should not, are you suggesting that we expand the bill? Is that what you're saying?
Well, first, we believe all caregivers in adult care should have continuing. And second, we do believe there should be an Alzheimer's component to it. And third, we really think it's very cumbersome to put it into statute. We think it should be an administrative rule because as things change, there's a need to change the hours and that sort of thing. And we think it makes it much harder to change if it's in statute.
Okay. I appreciate that. And the good thing about administrative rule is that they can adjust to change. The bad thing about administrative rule is that they can do away with everything that you want to have happen. And so I guess my feeling is that you have a statutory parameter that within which there is administrative rule. And I agree totally that, you know, administrative rule obviously needs to be there to make the necessary changes when they need to be changed. But I'm just wondering if we... First of all, I'm wondering if we need to expand this bill, and secondly, to make it a decide boards to allow the administrative rule to, you know, set the up-to-date requirements. But I appreciate you being here because I want to. That's why we have the public hearing on that bill. So I appreciate that. Greg, do you want to respond to that?
I will, Mr. Chairman.
Chairman.
Identify yourself if you would.
For the record, my name is Grover Simmons. I represent adult foster homes who are members of the Independent Adult Foster Home Association. To put this into context, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, the current law requires, as all of you know, 10 units of continuing education. And the bill that we proposed would have increased that requirement to 14 units, 7 of which could have been used for business training. So there was some concern about that bill from the department and the advocates, and so I met with Mrs. Cindy Hannum and Meredith Cody, the long-term care ombudsman, and as a result of that, Cindy recommended that the total be reduced from 14 to 12 units maximum, and from 7 units of business training down to 4. So the final numbers would be 12, up to four of which could be used for business. So I said, that's wonderful. We accept that proposal and we are together on it. Meredith had some concerns, not with the numbers, I understand, but with some other language. And so the amendment that Mr. Mercodian has reflects the concurrent agreement of the parties, to my knowledge, and so we support this, of course. If I might respond to prior witnesses' observation, the Alzheimer's organization, the Adult Foster Home Association would like to invite the Alzheimer's Association to come and give lectures, teach, discuss anything they wish with the Adult Foster Home members in our chapter in Salem. We are looking for speakers, and instead of having an adversarial relation which has existed, as far as I can remember, for years on end between these two organizations, we would like to extend a welcome to the Alzheimer's people to come and do some instruction to adult foster home caregivers. The first opportunity would be in about 2 weeks in Salem at our local chapter meeting. It's a luncheon down there. So I think that's a constructive idea.
Thank you. I'm going to call Mickey Pate. Now, would you like to respond to the adversarial association, the remark that he made? I didn't take that sitting down, if I were you.
In the past, certainly, and this is the Oregon chapter of the Alzheimer's Association, I am testifying for Alzheimer's Network of Oregon. We are a different group, although many of us were involved with the Alzheimer's Association. But over the years, of course, we are going to bat, I think it's inevitable, we go to bat for persons with Alzheimer's. We're advocates for them, whereas the industry obviously is in support of the providers. And so there's going to be a tension, and I think it's been
a healthy
tension, and out of it has come, you know, rules and regulations that have been modified one way or the other to try and end each agreement. But we do have different constituencies that we do certainly support. And that's, you know, it's inevitable that we're going to be
through. How do they cross over, though?
Well, it goes over, but certainly we're all looking for good care for people who are in adult foster care. I mean, that's
you have Alzheimer's.
Our members take care of Alzheimer's victims in large numbers, and more and more in recent years, because the level of care in foster homes is heavier than it used to be years ago, and many of those people have advanced dementia and Alzheimer's. And so, yeah, we take care of her people. So I cannot understand, Mr. Chairman, why we never get a support, Mr. Chairman, over the years.
Senator Cruz, I don't want a turf war. What I want is a response from the Department of the Dash 3's
delete three words from the dash two, basically.
I've not seen the dash two.
Okay.
You know, person may.
Yeah. No.
No, they sure
have to give you an education. They remove the dash two. They remove lines 20 or 29 on page 1 of the bill that removes the language and continuing education. That is the only difference in the two amendments. I want to comment on that. If that deletion is significant to the proponents of the dash twos.
Okay. I'm sorry, where is the deletion between 2 and 3?
Basically, it deletes those three words.
Oh, okay.
Mr. Chairman and Senator, I'm looking at my notes as a result of meeting with Cindy, and it says delete the new words. That is Cindy's view. She wants to delete those words, and we said fine.
That's what's in the
three. Okay, so where are you going on that?
The three do not delete those words.
Okay, so I don't have a copy of dash three either.
The only difference is the three do not delete those three words. So that's the question.
Mickey, would you
I'm going to take adult foster home program coordinator for students and people with disabilities.
Thank you. Now, I guess what I would like to get straight is we'd like to pass this bill, but I want to be sure that your views are accommodated. Now, is you mentioned administrative rule should be enough. Now, is did you hear her testimony?
Yes, I did.
Did you have any comments on that? Can you accommodate her concerns with administrative rule?
Well, we have certainly in the past used administrative rule to set out the requirements for training.
Okay.
However, the department doesn't have any objection to putting it into statute and putting the requirements into statute.
Correct. You mean for the Alzheimer's training, is that what you're saying?
Oh.
No, Mary's concern was that she spoke against the bill.
Yeah.
Because we don't need the bill. We can do it by administrative rule. Now, we do have a bill that sets some standards, but could we include her concern by administrative rule? And your concern is that you think there should be broader educational requirements. Is that right?
Well, I think that all caregivers should have continuing ed. And the thing is, the bill just relates to providers and resident managers who are considered providers.
Uh-huh.
And so they exclude all the other caregivers, which are the majority.
Okay.
And we're saying everybody needs that training. And I know that the amendment dash 3 said the department may by rule establish continuing education requirements for caregivers who are not providers. That may to us is rather iffy, though it says the department may establish continuing.
Well,
and so you're sort of separating the people who are the providers
and
everybody else. But you're kind of separating, you're differentiating between two groups of essential caregivers, providers, resident managers, and the rest of the caregivers, and it seems like they should all be included in one or the other.
If I could clarify, thank you, Chair. The dash two and dash three means both revert the language back to a person or not, so it's inclusive of anybody. It does take out that provider, resident manager. So the dash two amendment would require any person working in an adult foster home environment to get continuing education. So again, the dash two do revert that language back to the original bill. So it says here that the dash three amendments restore language that no person may provide care to residents of adult foster home without documentation of completing regulation requirements.
And 7-2.
So it seems to me that would be included.
In section 3, it does remain in that the department shall require all providers and resident managers to complete 12 hours of continuing ed. And the rest of the caregivers are not included in that.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, I don't mind only this and correcting it.
Providers are the owner operator in a foster home, or if they hire a resident manager who is in the home 5 days a week, 24 hours a day.
Yeah.
Those individuals have to take the department's basic training course, which involves training in all aspects of caregiving as well as care of the provider themselves. And if they hire substitute caregivers, the provider is responsible for seeing that they are trained and are in the care of the residents. They're also required to take a department workbook. And the training that they're required to do prior to providing care and service. The point being that the responsibility of care primarily falls to the provider or the resident manager who is supervised and is there as the primary caregiver. And certainly we want everyone who works with elderly disabled to have as much training as possible. And we're certainly striving toward that. I think our concern is that caregivers that are not providers or resident managers at times are totally in charge of a facility when those people are not on the site, and they need to have the same kind of background about how to deal with people who sometimes have severe behavioral problems, or they really need the same kind of care for them.
What is your suggestion for this bill?
I do have a real problem separating out the providers and resident managers, except for the business component. Other caregivers
don't do that. Do you have language that would be add to this bill?
I guess you can include all caregivers as being required that continuum education, all of them. But certainly for the majority, they wouldn't need the business component. And in our letter to you, we suggested that they get some all kinds of dementia.
I don't have the letter in my folder. I'm sorry.
We went on it more months ago.
Nothing is easy. But I would rather get it right and make it satisfactory to the people who are in the industry, and I don't have a problem with changing that. So what I'd like to do,
You have the government, it's your bill.
It seems to me that all employees there are going to find it necessary to serve the residents some time or other. And why would we exclude anybody from the training?
Mr. Chair and Senior Starr, I'm concerned about an hours requirement for substitute caregivers. If you have 12 hours of caregiving required of substitute caregivers, how are you going to have a battery of people available to you as a pool to come in for a day or half a day or a few hours? I think it would be such a limiting factor, it would have a down effect on the industry and would adversely affect the economics of the situation. When we suggested going to 14 hours for providers and resident managers, there was criticism among our members about, wait a minute, this costs us, whenever we take an additional hour or 4 hours of additional training, we have to hire somebody to come in and take our place, and it gets to be very expensive. So if you add that requirement to all substitute caregivers, I think you're going to have the industry not supporting that concept.
That's what I needed to hear.
Yes, sir.
I would agree with Grover. We currently require 10 hours of continuing education for providers. The department did have a group of trainers that went to various parts of the state, held training for providers on specific issues. Budget cuts, we don't have that ability anymore. But instead, we have developed home study courses and opportunities for providers to receive their continuing education. It is difficult for some providers, particularly those in rural areas, where they simply do not have access to continuing education. It does not mean by any means that they are not providing appropriate care and service. We hope that through our whole program with the licensors who are monitoring the home, we have a contact nurse program and case management, that the residents do receive the care required. Training has been a terrific issue, and it is something that providers complain opportunities are not available for training. Substitute caregivers, I'm sorry to say, and it's because of low wages and no benefits, they change frequently in foster homes. I don't see how it's realistic for substitute caregivers to be required 10 or 12 hours of training. It's just the reality. This is not going to happen.
Thank you.
Senator Scott.
I think, Mr. Chair, that responsibility falls back to the resident manager to provide at least basic information and training to those substitute caregivers. On-the-job sort of training would be necessary for anybody coming in, I'm sure. And it is the fact of the low compensation that we are stressed in this way. So I personally think that we need to move the bill forward with the MASH 2 amendments and to raise means and see what them to raise for the floor.
If I could just send you a message for a little bit. We who are representing Alzheimer's families are really concerned because the people who work in adult foster care homes they're wonderful caregivers. They're many wonderful ones. But they don't have the same level of training, many of them, that nursing home CNAs have. Even I know, I think some assisted living and residential care facilities require, you know, individually, not that it's in the world, but they do have CNAs on their staff. And the acuity level is really going up regarding dementia. And the reason that people end up in adult foster care often is because the family is totally, totally exhausted. They've cared for these people for years. They, as a last resort,
put them into long-term care. And remember that the caregiver in adult foster care may have 3 or 4, even 5 people who are confused and maybe belligerent and all. And that's leaving the door wide open for, at times, abuse. But simply because they're exhausted, like any family would be. And that's why we are very concerned about people who are caring for these people with dementia, not having the training that they need to do so. And they would get that through continuing ed. And often, as I say, substitute caregivers may be for quite an extended period of time the only person there to deal with the residents who have problems.
So what you're saying, though, is that the substitute caregivers, it's the obligation of the provider to, if they're a substitute caregiver, to train them, because they're very hit and miss and limited and so on and so forth.
But
and what you're saying is that the substitute caregivers need some training.
Definitely.
Okay, now, okay. Go ahead.
And I didn't want to correct the members of the committee. To the rule, if the provider or the resident manager is required to orient the caregiver to the care needs of the resident, the care plan, how to evacuate in case of an emergency, all of the emergency call numbers, how to reach the provider if they're not available. And like I say, they're required to take the caregiver preparatory training. There's no doubt about it that dealing with individuals with dementia and Alzheimer's disease is a specialty in and of itself. The provider is required to do very thorough screening before meeting with the resident and determine if they can meet those care needs. It would be unusual for a foster home, you have 4 or 5 clients with dementia unless the provider is quite skilled and being able to do that.
Okay, thank you all. Okay, we're going to close. The public hearing on 4:30, and we're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 4:30.
That's true.
Yes.
Senator, I'm going to adopt 2 amendments to Senate Bill 4:30.
Can you please adopt 2 amendments to Senate Bill 4:30? Discussion? Objections? Seeing none? May I move?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 4:30 as amended to the Senate floor for B-Pass recommendation.
Okay, Senate Bill 4:30. Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 4:30 as amended to the floor for the B-Pass recommendation. Would you call the roll, please?
Mr. Chair,
please.
Senator Metzger.
Excuse.
Senator Monson.
Excuse.
Senator Charles Starr.
I vote aye.
Senator
Paul. Aye. Okay, passed this bill to the floor with the D-Pass recommendation. I understand the concerns that were mentioned, and I think we need to pursue these, and I would ask Mary to please stay in touch. We need to talk about concern, and hopefully we can address them. If not through administrative rule, we will maybe come back and add some language at some point. But again, it's interesting because these are, as I say, it's not always easy to pass a bill. We have public hearings, we have amendments, we come back. We have more amendments, we have more public hearings, we come back, and finally we get to a point where we don't have always unanimous agreement. In fact, we all don't have unanimous agreement on our committee. And so we do the best job we can and move the bill out at will. Now this is not a referral, so it will go to the floor, and I will carry the bill. Okay, so we close the public hearing. We're going to at 6:00.
Okay, we are open for public hearing on Senate Bill 443.
Mr. Chair,
if I could make a comment, for the audience, we have two bills, Senate Bill 443 and 6505, that we have had several public hearings on. We were hoping to get amendments for them yesterday, didn't. We need to move them. Basically, just so everybody knows, what these two bills and aggregate will do will be to allow retired doctors to perform services in clinics without either the doctor having fear of liability or the clinic having fear of liability for the doctor's service in that clinic. So it's basically saying if somebody's a retired doctor wants to volunteer some services, they shouldn't have to worry about being sued. That's and it took us a long time to say something that simple in statute.
Well, nothing is simple.
This is kind of an extension of the Good Samaritan law, where a physician stops to help someone and is exempt in a sense from liability. This does allow physicians to actually go into a volunteer clinic, particularly in rural Oregon, and to work and the only time there would be a suit, and you can't eliminate it completely, is an egregious offense that
doing something illegal,
which is an egregious offense.
It's going to be a session.
Okay. We close the public hearing and open the work session on Senate Bill 443 and moving with dash 500.
Mr. Chair, I'll move the dash 500 amendment to Senate Bill 443.
Okay, Senator Coon, move the dash 500 amendment to Senate Bill 443. Any discussion or objection? Hearing none, the amendments are part of 443.
Mr. Chairman, I move to send a subsequent referral to Ways and Means on Senate Bill 443 with the subsequent approval of the President, and I move Senate Bill 443 as amended to the floor with a B-pass recommendation.
Okay, Senator Cruz moves 443 as amended, and removing the subsequent referral to Ways and Means with the approval of the President to the floor with the B-pass recommendation. Would you call the roll, please?
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Senator
Nixon? Excused.
Senator Mark Davidson?
Excused.
Senator Charles Bryce?
Aye.
Chairman Stein?
Aye.
Senate Bill 443 has passed. Close the public hearing. Close the work session, should we ask one of the sponsors to carry this, or would you like to carry this?
One of them could carry this one, and let Senator Bates carry the other one.
Okay. Senator Cruz will be the carrier of Senate Bill 443. We are going to open the public hearing on Senate Bill 605. We are going to close the public hearing because we do not have anyone to testify. We outweighed them. They all left.
It works that way all the time.
No, nobody signed up for this for the public hearing when they had a chance to sign up.
Okay, so we've opened the public hearing on Senate Bill 605. We close the public hearing on Senate Bill 605 and we open the work session on Senate Bill 605.
Mr. Chairman, move the dash 3 amendment, Senate Bill 605.
Senator Cruz moves the dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 605. Discussion?
No discussion or disagreement in the part of 605.
Mr. Chair, I move to send the subsequent referral to Ways and Means on Senate Bill 605, subject to approval of the President, and move Senate Bill 605 as amended to the floor for the D-class recommendation.
Okay. Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 605 as amended to the floor of the D-class recommendation, removing the subsequent referral to Ways and Means on the with the approval of the President.
Will you call the roll, please?
Vice Chancellor Clayton. Senator Metzger.
I move to send a subsequent referral to Ways and Means on Senate Bill 443 with the subsequent approval of the President, and I move Senate Bill 443 as amended to the floor of the be passed recommendation.
Okay, Senator Cruz moves 443 as amended, and removing the subsequent referral to Ways and Means with the approval of the President to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Now we can call the roll, please.
Vice Chancellor.
Aye.
Senator
Metzger. Excused.
Senator Maya Anderson.
Excused.
Senator Charles Ryan.
Aye.
Sam Hempstead.
Aye. Senate Bill 443 has passed. Close the public hearing. Close the work session ending. And should we ask one of the sponsors to carry this, or would you like to carry this?
We want to carry this one. We have seven of those carried yet. One.
Okay. Senator Cruz will be the carrier of Senate Bill 443. We are going to open the public hearing on Senate Bill 605. We are going to close the public hearing because we do not have anyone to testify. We outlawed it then. They all left.
It works that way.
No, nobody signed up for this for the public hearing when they had a chance to sign up. Okay, so we've opened the public hearing on Senate Bill 605. We closed the public hearing on Senate Bill 605, and we're opening the work session on Senate Bill 605.
Mr. Chairman, move the Dastri Amendment, Senate Bill 605.
Senator Cruz moves the Dastri Amendments to Senate Bill 605. Discussion.
No discussion or disagreement in the part of 605.
Mr. Chair, I move to send the subsequent referral to Ways and Means on Senate Bill 605, subject to approval of the President, and move Senate Bill 605 as amended to the floor for the pass recommendation. Okay, Senator Cruz moves Senate Bill 605 as amended to the floor for the pass recommendation, removing the subsequent referral to Ways and Means on the with the approval of the President. We can call the roll, please.
Vice Chancellor.
Aye.
Senator Metzger.
Excuse.
Senator Mike
Anderson. Excuse.
Senator Charles
Brown.
Aye.
Senator
Mike Beck. Aye. Senate Bill 605 passes unanimously through the car. To the floor of the due pass recommendation, and Senator Alan Bates, Senator Bates will carry the bill. It's his bill. I would like to mention, for the benefit of those of you who are not familiar with the Ways and Means process, if a bill has a fiscal impact of any kind, it is moved to Ways and Means, which is the budget committee, basically. Sometimes there is a referral that maybe we think for the wrong reason, or there may not be a significant impact. So we went through the procedure of removing that with the approval of the President of the Senate. Now, we have to write him a letter explaining why we're doing this, and he may or may not, we think in these cases he will, yes, remove that. If a bill goes to Ways and Means otherwise, it may die. Both co-chairs must agree to move it to a subcommittee, which then has to put it in its existing priorities and then has to fund it. So there are three steps it has to go through once it reaches Ways and Means, and it's very difficult.
and it's a judgment of someone who is not necessarily a ways and means person who puts that ways and means referral on it. And so it is one of the other frustrating things that we have to deal with in passing these bills. So,
and sometimes the bills are changed to where the referral is no longer necessary because it could have started off costing money and end up not costing money.
And sometimes they think there is no cost because they have an open position, and all of a sudden they find out that the open position has either been removed from their budget because they haven't filled it, and it's no longer open, and there is a cost. And so that, so there are reasons why they would do refer bills to Ways and Means, and it's very complicated.
Okay, we're going to open a public hearing.
We've got to close the work session first.
Work session is closed on whatever.
6:09.
We're opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 781.
No one who's here to testify would be explained a bit.
Just briefly, this is what you heard on the 17th, the Amendment Steering Group, Sections 1, 6, 7, and 9, in which Clean Mental Health, the state, and understand the proposed bill have all concurred on as appropriate. There's like no fiscal impact.
We do have... would you come up and just say something as long as you're here, please?
No, we closed the public hearing, I'm sorry.
We do have people from the mental health division which are in the audience in case there were people who had comments on the bill. They didn't sign up to testify. They are what we consider staff persons, although they are with the counties and not the state. The county administers the mental health program, and they have a vital interest in any legislation that goes on. This was a bill that took some negotiating as well, because there was a difference of opinion and work with segment of the community that deals with the mental health program. But those differences have been worked out, and so we are very happy to pass this bill along. So the public hearing has been closed. The work session is open.
Mr. Chairman, the -1 amendment to Senate Bill 781.
Okay, Senator Cruz moves the -1 amendment to Senate Bill 781. Objection? Seeing no objections, they are part of the main bill.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 781 as amended to declare the pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moved Senate Bill 781 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Would you call the roll, please?
Vice Chair Cruz?
Aye.
Senator Lexton?
Excuse.
Senator Mark Anderson?
Excuse.
Senator Charles Penn?
Aye.
Chair Monson?
Aye.
So, Senate Bill 781 passes to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and I will close. Before I adjourn the meeting, I just would like to just welcome again all of you who took the time to show up today, and thank you for your wonderful hospitality, the mayors of Sweet Home and Lebanon together. So thank you. And we will practice our wrap and do it another time.
You call and do the rap, I'll do the top.